The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like cake. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Hi, I'm Tony Hendra.
And I'm Jeff Chrysler.
And this is the final edition Radio Hour. We've been on hiatus for the last month, living the life of Riley, drinking, eating, plunging in the pool, basking in the cancerous UV rays of the ozone layer-free sun, endangering life, limb, and offspring, trying to find the AC control in heavy traffic, being eaten alive by giant mutated winged bugs impervious to bug spray, clawing frantically at the vast tormented patches of skin glowing scarlet from poison ivy, tearing to the ER with fifth-degree burns from the overturned piece of shit Walmart barbecue.
Whoa, Tony, relax. Take it easy. I know it's been a crazy summer, but get a hold of yourself.
I'm sorry, I get worked up about certain things, you know, wasps, EpiPens, you know.
That's usually a good thing. I mean, that's, after all, how we create our sizzling satire. Well, like this week's show, which is a flambé of lawsuits, impeachments, lawsuits leading to impeachments, and Sesame Street at the U.S. border.
True, we do burn those things. However, we have nothing to say, as everyone else does, about the Gaza situation. Why? Because we don't want to be accused of using each other as humor shields.
If you hadn't buried your punchlines underneath my setups.
And we consider it beneath us to zing the lunatic antics of Vlad the Putin and his merry band of henchmen.
Also, Tony, you like to travel to Europe by airplane, so...
Putin is great. Russia is lovely. Everything's fine.
Except for the bugs, sunburn, and poison ivy, right?
And that goddamn Walmart barbecue. I should have gone to Target.
And we're back. So tighten up your headphones, loosen up your funny bones, and enjoy the latest episode of...
The Final Edition Radio Hour.
There it is.
We are the Transportation Security Administration.
But you probably know us as the people who irradiate your balls.
Every day, airports in every major city flood with passengers trying to fly home to their loved ones, attend business encounters in exotic locations, or desert their families.
We need to protect those innocent people from terrorists who will attempt to board the plane with shampoo and mouthwash.
And that's why we need to irradiate your ball sack before you can board the plane.
We have to x-ray every American to expose all possible weapons and brighten our day with naked pictures of free Americans.
And bombard your balls with deadly radiation to protect future Americans.
Sometimes people ask, if we irradiate your balls, doesn't that kill future Americans?
Well, freedom isn't free.
Your children will have to make sacrifices for the sake of your children.
And your children's children.
Who will also make sacrifices.
Your noseless, mutated offspring will live in a secure nation where jihadists won't grab one of your children's children's children and cut off one of their multiple heads.
That's also why we probe your anus, to prevent trauma.
We search your bags to guard your privacy.
We confiscate your toiletries, to preserve toiletries.
And yes, we repeatedly kick you in the balls. To save the balls.
We are the TSA, the strongest, bravest, most well-trained legion of security professionals that Craigslist could muster.
MTV 7 presents Where Are They Now? The year was 2037, and Lanny Bonner was the hottest ticket on the teen pop charts. At age 20, she was a billionaire. At 23, her career was done. Now that people regularly live to 140 years old, Lanny Bonner is still a young and spry woman of 87. And she says she still hopes to return to pop stardom.
I tried to get Columbia Records on the phone for 40 years. I'm not a has-been. A lot of people still remember me. Some of them even try to get up and say hello.
And what about little Larry Beacon? At age 7, he was America's pal, playing Mandy Petty in the hit series Growing Up Gay. Now he's 103 years old and hasn't worked a day since age 9.
I keep my hair exactly the same. People notice.
Then there's Betty Spencer. At age 175, she is the oldest human being who has ever lived. But did you know at age 15 she hit the charts with her novelty hit song Where Is My Popo? And she hasn't done a thing since.
Where's my popo. Putting on a so-so. No polo, no popo. All the people who know that song are dead.
People you never think about because they're old. Here on Where Are They Now?
Have you been injured by a president? More specifically, have you been injured by a president who took executive actions because you yourself refused to take legislative action? Are you a moron, or have you just run out of ideas? I'm John Boehner for the law firm of Boehner & Boehner. We've been dedicated to suing the president since 2014. If you're upset about any part of the Affordable Care Act or other legislation, or just about the fact that the president is black, you may be entitled to a huge cash reward as well as impeachment proceedings. The Constitution's the limit. No, it isn't. Can we promise that everyone who sues the president will win? No. But we can promise that everyone who sues the president has a very good chance of fucking up the Democrats in the midterm elections, and that's just as good. Why am I doing this? Is it because I, too, fear my job will be taken away by some extreme nutbird the way it happened to Eric Cantor? I'd start crying, but I promised I wouldn't do that anymore. So if you're looking to soak democracy itself by taking steps that are stupid as well as disruptive, allow Boehner & Boehner to help you sue the pants off the black president.
And now, the human side of terrorism.
Are you there, Allah? It's me, Mohammed. First off, I want to apologize for taking time out of your busy schedule. I'm sure you have bigger juice to fry, but I have to confess, I have all of these emotions inside of me just waiting to explode, and not in the good way. Today is the big day, Allah. The day that I finally get promoted as Taliban's next suicide bomber. You have no idea how excited I am, Allah. This is such a huge opportunity. But I can't help but wonder, do I really deserve this? Am I ready to take on such an important role? Second wife says I'm overthinking it, that maybe my turban is on too tight. I know women are never supposed to be right, Allah, but I kind of hope she is.
Good morning, I'm David Gregory, and this is Meet the Press. 5 years ago this week was the Supreme Court's landmark Hobby Lobby decision. We all know what happened after that. Then last week, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that Christians may mention Jesus Christ being the Son of God as often as they feel like it, in any public or private setting, and can work it into any conversation, even if it's a complete non sequitur. Here to discuss the case known as God versus the Muslims is Pastor Larry Davenport, president of the Christian Defense Council. Good morning, Pastor.
Good morning, David.
And representing the other side of the question is Peggy Schmidlap, who is vice president of the Christian Defense Council.
Good morning, David.
Morning, Peggy. But she's a woman, so that kind of covers the birth control thing. Pastor, we'll start with you. Some people are saying that the Supreme Court may have finally gone too far in favoring one particular religion, in this case, Christianity. Obviously, you don't feel that way.
No, I don't, David. You see, over 240 years ago, the Founding Fathers established freedom of speech and freedom of religion. The overwhelming evidence suggests the religion they were thinking of was Baptist.
What would you say about the four liberal justices who made the point that many people who are Muslim or Jewish might not want to hear the good news about Jesus Christ in random everyday settings, such as a supermarket checkout line, the DMV, or an airport restroom?
David, no one's trying to convert anybody. We just don't want Christianity to die out.
Do you think there's much chance of that happening? I mean, the vast majority of Americans are Christian.
That's very true. So why are we fighting for our lives? Can you explain that one to me, David?
No, I can't. But is it necessary to send thousands of believers into the streets to stop people in the middle of their day and try to convert them to fundamentalist Christianity?
That's an oversimplification. We don't just stop people in the street, David. Sometimes we converge on their tables in restaurants.
But don't I have a basic right not to be bothered by an evangelical Christian while I'm eating dinner?
I don't think so. Once you leave your home, you're essentially saying to the world, ask me where I'm going to spend eternity.
Well, the liberal justices seem to feel that there's a time and a place to talk about God, and maybe it isn't
any We're not place talking to... about God. We're talking about Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
Excuse me, I was speaking abstractly about the idea of God.
I understand, David, and please don't do it anymore.
Peggy Schmidlap, do you feel, as many women do, that the Supreme Court went too far last year when it ruled in man waving a gun at an abortion clinic versus women trying to get an abortion, that the man had every right to point his gun at women entering the abortion clinic as long as he was just using it as a prop to scare them?
David, I'm against violence of any kind directed at anybody.
But you've gone on record, Peggy, as saying you thought the recent wave of abortion clinic riots were, quote, awesome.
David, my remarks were taken out of context. I didn't say the violence itself was awesome, just the symbolism of people from all walks of life coming together and surrounding abortion clinics with torches and pitchforks.
But women were repeatedly attacked in those riots.
Yes, but only women who were leaving the building and had already had their abortions. We're not monsters.
What about the argument that this string of pro-Christian Supreme Court decisions have led to the harassment and firing of millions of atheists?
We did an exhaustive study of that accusation and reached a very different conclusion, David.
And what did you conclude?
That story was made up by the Jews.
Well, that's all we have time for. I'm sure people of goodwill would agree that there's room in this country for all points of view, whether you believe in God or you don't. Thank you, Pastor Davenport and Peggy Schmidlap, for being on the show. This is David Gregory from Meet the Press saying good morning, and now let us bow our heads for the closing benediction.
Away, I will pay for your border policies. Can you tell me how to get to Refugee Street?
Hi, Minister Fuck It Up, I guess.
Hello, kids. Welcome to the border. Where do you think you're going, Juan and Juanita?
To the United States.
Land of the free and home of the brave.
Guess again. I have a message for you from the land of make-believe.
Where's the land of make-believe?
It's in a place called the Republican Party. You can't come in.
Why not?
They say you're a drain on resources. That if we let you in, we'd have to let other refugees in.
You do let other refugees in?
Yes. But not during an election year when the GOP is trying to win the Senate.
So political considerations trump humanitarian ones?
Now you sound like Mr. Pope.
Won't the Democrats say that? What about President Obama? What does he say?
He says he has no philosophical disagreement with Rick Perry.
I'm 5 years old, but even I know that can't be good.
He's asked for billions to help expedite a solution.
Wow! To get us into the United States faster?
No, to send you back where you came from faster.
This is the guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize? Is he completely heartless?
No, he's center-right. He has a heart.
But Mr. Fuckitupagus, wouldn't an influx of Hispanic children eventually swell the ranks of Democrats?
There's no eventually in politics, kids. There's only the next election.
All right, children. Come on. Let's go.
Who's that? Grover?
No, that's Mr. Druglord. He's taking you home to face a life of crime, degradation, and possible death.
But Mr. Fuckitupagus, can't we talk about this?
I'd love to. But we've got 50,000 other kids to deport. Don't let democracy hit you in the ass on your way back home.
Shitty day, sweet of mine, right away. I will pay for your border policies. Can you tell me how to get to Refugee Street?
The final edition.
On-the-job injuries, demand justice.
Medical malpractice, demand justice.
Parents threatening to turn off your cell phone? Demand justice.
Here at the law offices of Jacoby Ashurst and Duckface, we want to see you get the justice you deserve.
Justice for negligence.
Justice for child support.
Justice for getting shushed at a comedy show. What? I'm funny too.
Auto accident.
Embezzlement.
Your friend of me liking all the fat pics of you on Instagram.
Identity theft.
Fraud.
At work nip slips.
Have you been injured in a car accident?
Have you fallen victim to misleading diet pills?
Ever slipped in your own vom after blowing groceries at your birthday at the Gansevoort?
We're here to help.
We'll guide you through painful divorce proceedings.
We'll hold your hand through harrowing estate settlements.
We're here for you when you're feathered Etsy headband falls apart after jumping in that fountain at Bonnaroo.
We're here for you.
Integrity.
Justice.
Oh my God, this peach schnapps is not sitting well.
And now, the human side of terrorism.
Are you there, Allah? It's me, Mohammed. I don't mean to complain, but when is it my turn to take a break? I come home after a long day at work, and all I want to do is smoke my hookah and beat my wives in peace. Is that so much to ask? But the second I walk through the door, all I hear is my daughter screaming, "It's my burqa, no! It's my burqa! It's my burqa, no! It's my burqa!" I can't take it anymore, Allah. Now, I don't like to consider myself the kind of guy who stones his kids, but what else am I supposed to do?
The final edition asks the man on the street, should Congress impeach President Obama?
Impeachment? Wow, that's just over the top. That's ridiculous. I say hang the man.
I think that we should impeach President Barack Obama because I am a failure.
Can't we impeach him first and come up with a reason later?
This is a personal question. Can you be impeached for getting caught choking yourself during sex?
But what about Benghazi?
Wait, is he gay or black?
When are we going to start talking about the Jew?
Real pretty mouth on that president.
I think we just should impeach half of him, if you know what I mean.
If it weren't for him, people would be able to get sick and die just like we used to do.
That's a very interesting question, young man. Perhaps my little friend Alfie here would like to field that question. I think we ought to impeach the next...
And now, Jim Earle, author of Morning Remembrance, a collection of mocking obituaries, with this week's tribute to a real dead person, Don Levine, creator of G.I. Joe.
Don Levine, the Hasbro toy executive credited with doing more to distort America's concept of war than Bob Crane's errant penis, is now being outflanked by an army of ants. Levine's body was found four clicks out in his older sister's bedroom, his nails painted pink and his torso draped mockingly in a garish pistachio green gown. Born in 1928, the 86-year-old recently attributed his longevity to the fact that he never once set foot in a VA hospital. Levine first got the idea for the miniature figure while serving in the Korean War after he caught several Chinese soldiers hiding in his helmet. G.I. Joe hit the shelves in time for the 1964 Christmas shopping season, and soon millions of Americans were spending $4 apiece on the fake soldiers, or roughly half a real soldier's pension. The doll boasted 21 moving parts, including a pair of flexible shoulders John McCain would one day come to envy. Accessories included guns, grenades, and a little plastic quagmire full of souvenir jawbones. But the Vietnam War raged on and interest in the dolls waned. And sadly, parents soon discovered when they brought their G.I. Joes home, there were no parades. As the public shied away from military-related toys, Hasbro countered with the popular Upper G.I. Joe, whose main talent was being able to avoid combat due to digestive problems. Levine requested his body be laid to rest on a mattress of Kleenex tissues crammed inside an old shoebox.
For more insensitive, tasteless obituaries like that one, buy Jim's book, Morning Remembrance, at Amazon.com. Remember, morning is spelled with a U. M-O-U-R. Get it? Morning. Now spell it back to me.
And now, the human side of terrorism.
Are you there, Allah? It's me, Mohammed. Things have been on the rocks between me and my third wife lately. I don't know if it's me or if she's going through that teenage rebellion. Not to get all sentimental on you, Allah, but she was the first girl I ever raped. Please help me. I mean, us. Get that excitement back.
With luck, we'll be right back.
The 2016 presidential primaries are a long way off, but look out, for here comes Rick Perry of Texas, riding his state's taxpayer dollars into the GOP primary. Technically, he's not campaigning, yet he's popping up from New York to California, holding press conferences, running TV ads, meeting with money people, and telling everyone how terrific he is. In other words, campaigning. Officially, his cross-country ramble is meant to promote Texas as a corporate utopia that offers state subsidies, zero income taxes, low wages, hands-off regulation, and other cushy deals for corporations that relocate to the Lone Star State. It's a hustle that glorifies Perry, even though he's using Texas tax dollars to take good-paying jobs from the places he visits and turn them into poor-paying jobs in his state. But the governor is used to tapping the public treasury to feather his own nest, and he has recently tapped it again to the tune of $450 an hour. That's for a high-dollar lawyer he's hired at taxpayer expense to try to save his bacon and his presidential fantasies. He doesn't mention it on his out-of-state Praise Perry tour, but he's presently on the brink of being indicted for corruption back home. This mess involves the governor's clumsy attempt to stop an investigation by the state's ethics office into one of his pet slush funds that funnel taxpayer money to his corporate campaign donors. Last year, using a personal lapse by the director of the ethics office as an excuse, Perry simply vetoed the office's entire funding. No office, no investigation, no problem. This is Jim Hightower saying, clever, huh? Except that other funding was made available, so that investigation continues. And then a special prosecutor investigated Perry's ham-handed veto, so now his indictment looms. This could take the wheels off his roadshow.
And now a few minutes of Nurse Talk on TuneIn's Progressive Voices channel.
Last week, a historic rally took place in Detroit. Led by RNs and community leaders, over 3,000 people held signs and chanted, "Turn on the water."
Right now, with the political situation the way it is, one of the first things they've chosen to do is get their budget under control by closing off water to people whose bills are as little as 2 months behind. Now, for the people who owe the most money, the tens of thousands of dollars, they're not being done for payment.
This is going to happen to more cities than just Detroit.
Who would ever have thought that we'd have to send our nurses into what is becoming a disaster area, a man-made issue, turning off people's water?
Here we are almost a year later, and Republicans are still trying to abolish the PPACA. So how are things really going? Let's hear the good news first. What's working?
We're seeing a lot of people who are able to get care who sometimes were denied even the purchase of a policy before because of pre-existing conditions or other issues.
So what are some of the challenges that you're hearing about?
Those of you in California certainly will have heard about some of the challenges there. There's been a lawsuit filed recently by Consumer Watchdog on behalf of patients who signed up for coverage through the California Exchange, thinking they'd still be able to see their own doctors, and then found out later on their doctors weren't even a part of those networks.
Right.
We still have over 30 million people in this country who have no access to coverage at all.
10 more things nurses wish their patients knew.
Number 10. Oh no, we're not just sitting playing on the computer. We're charting every detail of your mental, physical, emotional well-being over and over and over.
Number 9, it's not me hurting you, it's Russian separatists. No, I'm just kidding. It's a needle.
You've been listening to Nurse Talk. Be sure to join us for a full hour weekends on TuneIn's Progressive Voices channel.
You are listening to the Final Edition Radio Hour, Satire with Teeth. Jeff, I've been thinking a lot this year about the National Lampoon, because 40 years ago, 1974, was really the glory year, the glorious year of the glory years of the National Lampoon, when it was at its height in terms of fame, in terms of writing, and in terms of audience circulation. And I thought it might be interesting to play a story that I told of the Moth about 12 or 13 years ago about a very, very important person in my life who was kind of my mentor at the National Lampoon. Here we go.
Our last storyteller tonight, once again, is Mr. Tony Hendra. He joined us last May. He told a story at Planet X. He got our very first standing ovation, not to jinx him. We are thrilled to have him back. Please, Tony, we're very happy to have you. Please join us up here. Thank you.
I have a confession to make. I was once on the Ed Sullivan Show. It was in the late 60s, and I was part of a comedy team. And my partner and I appeared right after Topo Gigio and right before Pablo Casals. That was kind of Ed's sort of continuum, you know, Jackie Mason, Maria Callas, the interesting folk dancers of bulimia. Actually, I have another confession to make. We appeared several times on the Ed Sullivan Show. But I'm not bragging. It was very good for your career, but it was horrendous. Ed was a prick, and his show was a nightmare. In fact, whenever we went on, my partner and I would call it Night of the Living Ed. You never got any laughs. It was a graveyard of laughs. It was like playing a Requiem Mass in St. Patrick's. Not laugh one. Unlike Aristotle, Ed seemed to feel that it was comedy, not tragedy, that should incite the audience to fear and pity. But it was actually worse than that, because this was 1968. And Ed was rabidly pro-war. He used to love to have Vietnam vets on the show. You know, these poor kids who'd just come back from defending freedom and had lost arms and legs. He especially liked it if they'd lost arms and legs. And I remember one Sunday, he had a whole group of them, these paraplegic vets, sitting down in the audience in their wheelchairs with their crutches and their stumps and so forth. And he got the audience all worked up, you know, the yellow peril and the red menace and defending freedom and all the rest of it. And the audience reached a fever pitch, and he looked over to his kids and he said, "Stand up, boys, take a bow." I hated Ed. I hated the Ed Sullivan Show. Because beyond that just detestation of Ed, I was a traitor. I was a traitor to my generation. I was a traitor to those poor kids. I was also a traitor to the other kids who wanted to bring them home. I was a traitor to my convictions. I worked on television. And then I met a man, a writer, a small-town American from Utica, New York, who changed my life. This guy was far beyond anything that I had ever met before. He was a walking comedic nuclear event. He was the big bang in my personal humor universe. He was obsessed by death. He thought that death was the only real joke. You know, God gives us life, then he kills us. Hilarious! So therefore, he was obsessed by religion. He was obsessed by Hiroshima, of course. He was obsessed by the Holocaust. And he rammed his outrage about these things, that humans could do this to others, other humans, in your face. He outraged people with his outrage. Most of all, he was obsessed by pain. Now, all humor is pain. My pain, other people's pain. That's what humor is. But this guy wanted to inflict pain, especially on the scum up at the top. Whether it was Nixon, Kissinger, Andy Warhol, Jane Fonda, or Mick Jagger. Made no difference. In fact, it wasn't just us versus them for this guy. It was us versus scum! And the funny thing was that physically, he was completely unable to combat anything. He just wasn't capable of it. He was soft and rather sweet. He had ruby red lips. And he had the musculature of an oyster. but he was without fear. And what made his insane rage stick was an absolute manic precision for words. He was a poet of humor. He used to live over here in Soho, long before Soho became a shopping mall for Eurotrash, and in a huge old loft on Spring and Green. And it was unlit and unheated, and it was packed with the most curious detritus: headless dolls and legless mannequins and stuffed animals and birds and old weapons and things inside other things, which all in his world were perfectly ordered, perfectly neat, and somehow hilarious. And in, right in the middle of this brilliantly ordered chaos, there was a file cabinet full of index cards, on each one of which there was an idea of exquisite horribleness. A comic haiku with hardcore high explosive at its center. And the other thing about him was that if you ever touched one of those words once it was in place, he went crazy. Woe betide the editor who tried to change a single word of this guy. Those words are mine! Mine, you hear? Don't touch them! His name was Michael O'Donoghue. And he taught me everything I know about offending people. If I learned from Michael how to put words together that would make people throw up, walk out, cancel their subscriptions, they'll threaten to have me deported. And we both worked at a magazine called The National Lampoon. Do I hear... Oh. For one wonderful moment, I thought I'd offended somebody. We both worked at the National Lampoon back in the early days, but I wasn't really working with Michael. Being with him was like a revelation. It sort of somehow, this coruscating venom that came from him tapped into my deepest rages and fears and passions and beliefs. And anything could be said. Anything could be thought, believed, whispered, shouted. And somehow it all came out intoxicatingly funny. Michael showed me, in fact, that what I'd been doing up to that point, being a clown, a comedian, was really irrelevant. Humor wasn't just an escape, a relaxation, a time off from serious business. Humor was serious business. He had a great expression. He said, "Making people laugh is the lowest form of humor." Now, I'll give you an example of this. In my very first issue at the National Lampoon, which he and I really did together, which was called Is Nothing Sacred, we had a lot of great stuff. Apart from anything else, we had Paul Davis's very famous poster of Che Guevara. Poster of Che Guevara. Except it had a cream pie in it. But the best piece in the issue was something that Michael wrote, and what it was called was the Vietnamese Baby Book. And it was a baby book. It was beautiful in the way that the Lampoon did it its best. It was perfectly produced. It was baby blue. It was incredibly cute, saccharine sweet. Except, of course, all the entries were for a Vietnamese baby. So there were things like baby's first word, medic. Baby's first stump. Baby's first funeral. It was fantastic. It burned itself into your mind. It was so simple, so exquisite, so horrible. I think it was the finest piece that I've ever seen written about the Vietnam War. And, of course, it worked. Less than 2 years later, Nixon resigned. But we didn't just go after Republicans. We were hardest on our own. And we did actually, right after that, we did an album for the National Lampoon called Radio Dinner. Not to toot our horn too much, but this one, particular one, we decided we'd go after our own sacred cows. People like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, and especially John Lennon. And at this time, Lennon he was already with Yoko, and he had for some reason gone into primal scream therapy. And in his arrogance, this was like 1971, 72, he had caused to be printed in Rolling Stone a transcript of one of his sessions, in which he just ranted about everybody, about the Beatles, about Yoko, about his auntie, about everything. And so Michael had a brilliant idea. He said, "Why don't we just take this, make it into lyrics, and sing it as John Lennon?" And that's what we did. I'd like to give you a little taste, if I can, just to remind you. I can't really do this justice because it had a great piano accompaniment when we did it back then. But it's sort of interesting in terms of its method. Here goes. I resent performing for you fuckers. Tell me, what do you know? A bunch of faggot middle-class kids wearing long-haired trendy clothes. Look, I'm not your fucking parents, and I'm sick of uptight hippies coming knocking at my door with a fucking peace symbol. Get this, fab fans. I don't know you fuckers anything, and all I got to say is fuck you. And it went on from there. Well, we had a falling out. It was about a woman, isn't it always? And with Michael, if you had a falling out, that was it. Till death do us join. It was forever. I wasn't the only one. Michael's life was littered with ex-best friends. But looking back at it now from, you know, this vantage point, I don't think it was sex. Certainly not in the early 70s when everyone in New York was humping like small mammals in a haystack. I think it was a pretext. I think Michael felt he had to get rid of me. Because he knew, even though we were equals and friends and so forth, that at some level I did regard him as a mentor. And he couldn't be a mentor, because a mentor is an authority figure. And as far as Michael was concerned, all authority figures needed their throats slit. He had a wonderful image, actually, for a slit throat. He called it the second smile. Not long after that, he left the magazine and he went to join a fledgling television show called Saturday Night Live. Where he was first a writer and later a character you may remember called Mr. Mike. And I think it destroyed him. Now, I know that the conventional wisdom, which is to say the wisdom of television, is that Saturday Night Live was revolutionary. But I don't pray in that cathedral. Thank you, Nancy. I think that television is, in the real world, always counter-revolutionary. I think it takes Saturday Night Live, Ed Sullivan, the Rodney King beating, the Challenger explosion, whatever you like, really, and turns it all into the same acceptable norm. So Mr. Mike was not Michael O'Donoghue. Mr. Mike was scum-approved nihilism. He was a Polaroid of dissent, the sound without the fury. It used to break my heart to watch him. This great comedic genius, perhaps the satiric genius of my generation, trapped inside a piece of furniture in the corner. You remember him? He used to do some strange bit about sticking needles in his eyes. Does anyone remember that? Yeah. Well, would you want to applaud that, really? I'm not sure, you see, because it wasn't his eyes he was sticking it in. It was Tony Orlando and Dawn's. He was doing an impression of Tony Orlando and Dawn having needles stuck in their eyes. I don't know. I suppose it was weird. I suppose it épatait les bourgeois, but this was from the author of the Vietnamese baby book. Anyway, Michael didn't do very much after that. He sort of potted around on the fringes of the New York scene for about the next 15 years. And then one day in 1994, that great dark star of negative energy, his brain, exploded. A massive cerebral hemorrhage, closely followed by the only real joke. And it broke my heart for all the obvious reasons, but also because it was an opportunity lost, which I will never have again in my lifetime, to be present at Michael O'Donoghue's deathbed. Yeah. Because whatever we go to, whether it's light or darkness, that would have been amazing. If darkness, to hear that mad cackle as he slid off into oblivion. And if the other, if what he saw up ahead was light and life, oh, the look on his face. And see, Michael, there's Christ and Moses and Buddha. Oh, fuck. Well, I wasn't invited to his wake. None of his ex-best friends were. But if I had been, this is a little story I would have told about him. It's one of my fondest memories of him, and I'll finish with this. This was back in 1972, right after Radio Dinner. And we had offended many people with Radio Dinner. Especially in the counterculture and the underground. And one morning, Michael came into my office smoking a cigarette, which for some reason he always did between his two middle fingers, like a Nazi officer used to. And in his other hand, he had a brown paper parcel, which he had just opened. And he took this brown paper parcel and he threw it across the office. It landed on my desk with a crash. And in it were 9 sticks of dynamite, which some friend had sent us. Now, normally, dynamite is not particularly dangerous. You need a blasting cap to set it off. But this dynamite was old and discolored. It had gone crystalline. And crystalline dynamite will blow up if you breathe on it. It was an absolute miracle that Michael hadn't blown me, him, and half the future of American comedy across Madison Avenue. I told him to get out of there, which is what I was doing right now. But no, he didn't. He loved that dynamite. He picked up a stick of it and felt it and rolled it around like a good cigar. He loved the dynamite. He identified with the dynamite. Well, I did get out of there and went across the street to a bar, and you know, it was 11 o'clock in the morning, had a very large scotch, and the bomb squad came with their, you know, their strange machine that they put things in, and the big suits that make them look like California raisins. And they did their piece and saved the day and so forth and so on. And then everything had died down a little, I went back up into the Lampoon, and there in the lobby was my best friend in attack mode with his glasses off, surrounded by perhaps a dozen very worried-looking cops. And this is what he was saying. Give it back, you pigs! That's my dynamite! It's mine! Give it back, you scum! And I think that was the happiest moment of my life. Thank you. Okay. Thank you all for coming. Please don't forget, sign your names. Thank you for coming. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to Joey. Let's all applaud ourselves. Thank you to our improv people. Another fantastic evening at the Mock. Thank you, everybody. Have a good evening.
This week on the Discovery Channel, the stories behind all the horror movies that are based on a true story. Featuring the NYPD sergeant's true accounts that inspired Deliver Us From Evil.
Yeah, so we walk in and the guy was writing weird stuff on the floor. It was weird.
Shocking. And the real events behind The Haunting in Connecticut.
We went upstairs and from the attic we heard a knocking. It might have been old pipes, but it might not have been.
Hold on to your hats. And, believe it or not, the story behind The Hills Have Eyes.
The origins go back to 15th century Scotland, where a town said, "Hey, who are those weird people in the hills?" And they got them. True story.
And don't forget the actual events behind The Exorcist.
So she started going, and she was cool. And we had a snack.
Unbelievable. Tune in this week for all the outrageous stories that created based on a true story, like what might have been an exorcism or just bad fish in The Exorcism of Emily Rose, or the case of black mold that created The Conjuring. Discovery has them all. Or just watch The Wolf of Wall Street, a horror movie that's a true story.
And now, the human side of terrorism.
Are you there, Allah? It's me, Mohammed. What's wrong with kids these days? My eldest daughter, the legitimate one, was wearing a burqa the other day that was solo cut. I could almost see her nose. When I told her to change, she told me that this was the style and that nose showing is no longer considered inappropriate. I'm worried about her, Allah. Second wife says she's been sneaking out of the house to go to school. When I confronted my daughter about this allegation, she confessed that she went to school once, but swore that she didn't do any reading. What do I do, Allah? Do I let her off the hook or keep her hanging at the end of our leader's rope?
Hello, my name is Larry Merkin, and I recently received my Juris Doctorate from the University of Phoenix. This is a personal message to our President of the United States, Barack Obama, to consider me, Larry Merkin, Juris Doctor from the University of Phoenix, as part of your legal team against House Republican leader John Boehner. Hey, I think that guy is a total douchebag, and I'll work real hard for you. So seriously consider it, Mr. President Obama. I think you're the real deal, and so am I. Ego, we'd make a pretty good team. Contact me directly. I'll have one of your people get in touch with me at 1 888 Merck Law. And don't worry, I'm very discreet.
This has been a paid advertisement for Larry Merkin and has absolutely no affiliation with this or any other entity in the world.
Welcome, Santa Cruz chapter of Friends of the Humpback Whale, to another of our whale spotting voyages off the beautiful Central California coast.
Hi.
Good to see you. Of course, we all know and love the legendary Songs of the Humpback Whale. But you know, what are far less known and in their way just as beautiful are the farts of the humpback whale.
Really?
Oh, wow.
There's one of the lovely creatures now. Perhaps we'll get lucky. Unlike the humpback songs, which can only be heard underwater, its farts are quite audible at sea level. You see, they come up to the surface to fart.
Well, I suppose that's some rudimentary form of courtesy to other whales.
That's a pretty thought. Oh, there she blows!
Is that a spout?
Like a spout. It's hot air becoming vapor ahead of the actual fart. With luck, we're about to hear one.
Will we be able to smell it, too?
The farts of the humpback whale do not smell. Oh, hark!
That is so haunting.
I know. The richness, the profound power. It's like a mighty organ of the sea.
Well, it comes from an organ.
To me, it speaks volumes.
It's sure releasing volumes.
Greg, stop being a smartass. You're spoiling it for people.
There's another spout.
I always thought the spout came from its blowhole.
It's just a different blowhole.
The sheer majesty of it is mind-blowing.
What happens if you light one of their farts?
Actually, humpback whale farts are so powerful, you can light them underwater.
Wow. Has anyone ever done that?
Yeah. There's a group of scuba divers in Malibu dedicated to lighting humpback whale farts underwater. They call themselves the California Fast-Moving Fart Patrol. Oh, look. A whole pod of whales approaching our boat.
Oh, they're coming quite close. How beautiful they are.
Do humpback whales communicate by farting?
Yes, one will fart and another will fart back. Listen.
Why are they surrounding us with their tails towards us?
By turning their backs, they're showing their trust in us fellow mammals. It's a gesture of peace and friendship.
Oh, man, do you smell that? That is friggin' toxic. Something died inside that whale.
Hey, I told you, humpback whale farts are odorless.
Yeah? Well, don't light a match.
I hate to say this, but I think they're farting at us.
It's a whale fraternity, a gesture of fraternal flatulence.
Really? I thought these majestic animals were above this kind of sophomoric humor.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, Lord.
Krill farts are the worst.
Go placidly amid the noise and waste, and remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to our support group for over 40-year-old men who watch the HBO show Girls. Who would like to begin?
I will. Hello, everyone. I'm Frank. I'm an over 40-year-old man, and I watch HBO's Girls.
Hello, Frank.
I was watching from the beginning. I thought the show was really funny. I rooted for this girl, even though she was flawed. I wanted to see if she would survive in the big city or end up back home in Michigan.
So what happened, Frank?
I have a hard time with this.
Go ahead. It's okay. We are all here for you.
Well, That was just a story about a self-involved jackass who's not likable. Why would HBO make a show about a completely unlikable character?
What about Curb Your Enthusiasm?
That was the point of the show! That was the point! From day one, you were like, ah, this Larry David is a bastard over shrimp. I got that. I don't get girls.
I just have to say something, because Frank's really touching on a nerve here.
Go ahead.
Hello, I'm Steven. I'm an over 40-year-old man, and I watch HBO's Girls.
Hello, Steven.
I'm getting very angry about this.
Let it out. It's why we are here.
How can HBO do this? They are known for greatness. Sopranos, Six Feet Under, The Wire. The Wire!
Don't forget Game of Thrones, for the light's sake.
Oh, yes. Those are all very intelligent, mature shows. But remember, they don't always have hits. How about John from Cincinnati?
Yes, but it didn't become insanely popular and considered the comedy of its generation.
I gotta step in. I'm Bill. I'm an over 40-year-old dude, and I watch HBO's Girls.
Hi, Bill.
I don't get Lena Dunham's nakedness all the time. Sure, one, two times, it's great that the un-Hollywood beauty is showing skin. That's brave. That's artsy. But when it feels like every scene is an excuse for her to show her bubbies, I don't want to see it. I'd rather see Peter Scolari nude again.
Yes, and it makes me want to see Allison Williams naked even more. And I feel creepy about that. I want to see all the rest of them naked. If Lena Dunham's going to take off her clothes, then I want it balanced with the rest of them. But they won't!
None of them will, except for Lena Dunham. Put your clothes on, Lena Dunham. Why won't HBO stop her? She's naked more than the whole cast of Rome during the entire series. Where's Judd Apatow? He's the executive producer. Why doesn't he put her clothes on?
And there is no way Patrick Wilson would bang Lena Dunham for a weekend. It should have been Shoshana, you know, David Mamet's daughter.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
She's funny.
Good point, guys. Glad you're getting this all out. Much more productive than my support group for 30-year-old women who watch Entourage.
Well, you watched that for Jeremy Piven and Lloyd. I mean, there was something there. Even Kevin Dillon had his moments.
Sure. Now, to clear things up for us, I've brought in a 22-year-old girl to explain the appeal of Girls.
Oh my God, Girls is awesome. Didn't you guys read Vogue? Lena Dunham is a comedic genius, the queen of comedy. She completely speaks to my generation.
Carol Burnett is the queen of comedy.
Who?
Look, Lena Dunham plays a character who does not think about anyone except herself. Anyone. She was at a funeral and was asking the widow about her book deal.
Exactly. That's how awesome she is.
Let's make her watch True Detective.
Okay,
guys. Good meeting. FYI, I have a new support group starting next week. It's for those who are still angry that Carnival was canceled.
Oh, yeah, good.
Oh.
I am. I'm going to go.
Yeah.
Hold her legs. Hold her legs.
Well,
do you have a... What channel is HBO on here?
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hindra, Jeff Hendrick, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Ann Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The Final Edition Radio Hour is written, at one time or another, by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hindra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, David Eskridge, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, and Steve Rosenfield. The Final Edition Radio Hour is produced by Tony Hindra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast producer Barry Lank. The Final Edition Radio Hour is edited and audio produced by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. This episode's audio engineer was Eric West. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2014.